Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This is episode 32, titled The Heart Sutra, Part 2.
May I ask a question?
Sure, of course.
This seems like a very powerful way of answering one problem that Christianity has had, which is the idea of free will. So the idea of free will seems to be that one is exempt from all the other causal processes in the universe. That mm-hmm. Nietzsche said it was that you're self-caused, mm-hmm. and he said that was crazy. Is that the same idea here?
Well, not quite, because...
Is there a view of free will here?
Not quite. You see, the free will thing, the scientists think there's no such thing as free will, because we're all robots, right? So they're great on causality, but what they're not allowing, because of their fear of the mind, fear of the subtle level of reality, of subtle mentality, they're in denial that they have a mind. Everything's just objective, robotic causal processes, and mind is not a causal process within that. Once mind becomes a causal process within that, however, choice makes a difference. You choose this and go that way, or you choose that and go this way. That makes a difference.
But choices
are not there is a relative. There is relative free will. You don't need absolute free. Actually, absolute free will would not be able to do anything because it couldn't connect to any relational situation. So there's no absolute free will, but there's also no absolute lack of free will. There is relative free will because there's choice. There's critical choice. You engage in the causation, and then the mind is a very powerful thing. The human mind, or divine mind, the more highly evolved being's mind, is very powerful. But even the Pac-Man, bacterial mind, chooses to eat this or that. It's a set of question of choice.
But is the idea that choices are themselves not caused?
Not absolute, but relatively.
Don't we all have conditioning that conditions?
Yeah, there's conditioning,
choices.
Always conditioning, but yet there is within the conditioning, it makes a difference. I can, bang my head on the wall or not bang my head on the wall, and that makes a difference. And once that's very important, because otherwise, you're helpless. I just did it because I had to do it. It's like that. And then there is nothing you can do to evolve. You would always just be driven by habit in whatever way it was. And there's a huge amount of that, but this is another big difference between Buddhist psychology and Hindu psychology, actually. Not just Buddhist, Indian psychology, we can just say, let's forget all Phil, but it's Indian thing, and Western, which is that from Freud, which is that Indian psychologies are fully aware of the unconscious long before him, but they weren't content to just have an unconscious. They wanted to become conscious of the unconscious. All of that, all those weird images you see, deities, yogas, chakras, it all means going down into your own nervous system and learning even the autonomic nervous system. An enlightened person doesn't have to inhale, actually. They could pass those witches tests in the Middle Ages. They don't have to inhale involuntarily. They choose to remain present in an oxygen, like a body embodiment that seems like an oxygen thing, but they don't have to. Because you can completely unprogram, the beauty of the human being is it's completely unprogrammable and reprogrammable, which is the danger of a human being also. They can be programmed into monsters, anyone, or they can be programmed into saints. And there's the choice of the person to program themselves. There's always a choice, relatively speaking. Relative free will is free enough.
What was Hitler doing when he was speaking to people and moving them? Were they
had a good PR. He had Goebbels. Had Karl Rove.
Right, what was
he had
Karl
previous
to?
Life of Karl Rove.
But what was he speaking to?
Huh?
He was speaking to people whose buttons he knew how.
He
to
was
push.
Speaking to people who loved Bach and Beethoven.
Right.
And they were great people, and they remain great people. And he was picking on the Jews. who were there with those people, because those people were nicer to them than the friggin' British and Portuguese and Italians and Spanish and Russians previously.
But
then there were a lot of them there, and then they were in a desperate situation being squeezed by a bunch of people outside, especially British and French and U.S., and they were so poor and freaked out that they were ready to listen to this loony. And they didn't, of course, as people don't, they didn't realize how loony he was until later, because he had Karl Rove.
Okay.
He had advertising agency, you know. He had Lena Riefenstahl, you know.
So they were
theater.
Ready, they were ready to have him push.
Yeah, and Wagner had also been programming him in some sort of Wotanic blood cult and all bullshit, you know.
Right, but that all sounds like it wasn't choice, that was programmed.
Well, there still was choice. There were some Germans who hid a bunch of Jews in their cellar at the risk of their own life. A lot of them. There was choice. Of course. There's always choice. And that always makes a difference. Relatively. There's no absolute choice. It's a relative choice. Is the thing. So it doesn't solve the problem in some absolute way that you like. Anyway, okay, never mind. So I shouldn't diverge into politics and history. Everybody will freak out. Point is, this is the original mantra. When the Buddha, when Shariputra and Maudgalyayana, the two top monks, were looking for a teacher, they saw this guy, Ashvajit, who was one of Buddha's five first disciples, in a bazaar, and they thought there was something special about him. And they thought his teacher must be really cool. So they kept bugging him, "Please tell us what your teacher teaches." And he said, "You don't ask me. I'm just an old monk. Go see him. He's in the forest out there, like a half a mile out of town." And they said, no, but you should say something. Say something. So then he said this, "Om ye dharma hetu prabhava hetun tesham tathagata hi avadat tesham chayo nirodo evam vadi mahasramaniye swaha." And so the om is used as a mantra, but what he said was, ye dharma hetu prabhava, those things produced from causes, the tathagata, which means the one who has become realistic, who has gone to reality, declared what are those causes, hetun tesham. Of them he made a declaration. So in other words, he understood how causality works, of free will, unfree will, conscious, unconscious, all of that. And what is their cessation? Tesham cha nirodo. You see nirodo, you remember your yoga sutra? Chittavritti nirodaha. That's the same word, nirodo. That means nirvana. Because it means dukkha nirodo, the cessation of suffering. They're all in the same gang, you know, those Indians. This whole Buddhist Hindu thing, some later thing, a bunch of Brahmins freaking out. They're all in the same gang. Evamvadi, and evamvadi means that's what he advocates. Thus he advocates. Evamvadi. He is an advocate of such, literally. Mahasramaniye. And Mahasramaniye is usually translated the great ascetic. But I don't call it ascetic. I translate it the great vacationer. Shramana is someone who goes to an ashram. When you go to an ashram, are you vacationing? Yes. You're trying to. Sadly. And so Mahasramana is a great vacationer. What are you vacationing from? Taxes, family obligations, profession, whatever. If you're a woman, childbirth starting at 13 in India at that time. You know, it was very tough for her to be a woman in patriarchal society. But everybody had a lot of problems. So Shramana was one who wandered forth seeking a higher reality. And he went to an ashram, and Maha Ashramaniya means the great vacationer, you know, the great retreater, the great visitor to the yogi, Buddha and yogi's retreat. So, okay, all science works with causal processes. Buddhist science taught by the higher educations called Adishiksha, which is still the word for education in Hindi, Shiksha is, in ethics, mind, and experiential wisdom. People constantly talk about training, and there are times of training, but it's actually more like education. Okay. Now, this is what I'm saying. And I think this helps you as yogis. Definitely helps you medically about your healing of yourself. Shunyata is a physicist's discovery. It is not some religious thing, mystic thing. It's an experimental, experiential discovery. The experiment is in your own body-mind, like David said. You make your body an instrument that is better than a cyclotron. You know, these guys build $11 billion cyclotrons under the ground in Switzerland, nearby good cafes where they sit while the thing's been around them. And they discover the Higgs boson and this and that, and they still don't know anything. They're still freaking out because every time they find something, it dissolves under their analysis. Mm-hmm. And in 1926, Heisenberg and Niels Bohr said they're never going to find anything. It will always dissolve under their analysis. Therefore, they have to give up the fantasy of an absolute objectivity and realize that reality, the mind is interwoven with reality, and the observer affects what they observe, which means mind is part of reality, is part of the causal process. But they're in denial of that since thing because they feel threatened. You realize, right here we're sitting, we feel secure sitting on the floor. This is not an earthquake zone, we think. And I was thinking about it, trying to, I hope it isn't. So a bunch of trees could fall down on you. So we feel very secure here. Okay, you put your mind, scientists are yogis too. And they put their mind in the lab and they're down there where like it's a particle or a wave. What? You know, or is there a dead cat there? They get into all kind of really weird things. Is the cat in there dead or alive? I don't know why they do that. Some poor cat. They must be allergic. And they're feeling insecure. And subliminally, the human beings have been feeling that since 1945. Because in 1945, we all know what happened. Seemingly stable atoms in Hiroshima and Nagasaki of houses and people and cloths and stones and everything. The atoms in them released this immense energy and totally vaporized everything around. And then in a higher circle, some horrible burning and scalding and horrible stuff. But the main point is that was the atoms themselves, a chain reaction. So that means our atoms, so-called atoms, are not things that can be relied upon. That means they're unstable. They could explode. They can't be found when you really look for them. Like me, my body. No, I couldn't find my own body if I really looked for it. With a high tech. So what I'm saying here is that the yogic body mind is a physical instrument with the deep consciousness to discover the nature of reality. And they predicted the discovery in 1926 by the quantum physicists that everything you examine dissolves under analysis. And causal reality is utterly unstable. But luckily, also, there is no nothingness. In other words, when you don't find that atom that you're looking for, you didn't find nothingness. You do not. That's just an expression. Somebody who thinks, we will say, right? Oh, did you look for the thing? Oh, there was not. Oh, I found nothing there, we'll say. But I didn't find nothing. I just didn't find what I was looking for. The nothing never gets found. Luckily, beneath the nothing is clear light of the void, infinite potentiality, Satchit Ananda. And everyone agrees. All those scientists agree, luckily. So Shunyata Karanakarbham is there for a physical discovery. It's reality. Therefore, these people are teaching something realistic. Therefore, their yoga system is a real way to liberate yourself from stress and find the deeper bliss of your actual being and reality. And therefore, when you're sick, you have the healing power inside yourself and inside your field, inside the ground around you, the world, the leaves, the trees, the this and that, the nutrition. Your own cells have the healing energy in them. It's very, very powerful. But people who go alternative, so-called complementary alternative medicine, they don't think that because they have faith in these lunatics who are at MIT and they think they discovered nothing. And they assure you they found it. And you're a primitive, old-fashioned person. Buddhism, future life, what evidence? That's ridiculous. We know there's nothing after death. We know we don't exist. And there's no purpose and meaning or anything to life. We know all that. We know that. Oh, yeah, we're at MIT. We have PhDs. We have labs. We know that. So they run around thinking they discovered nothing. They won Nobel Prizes for it. Who's going to get a prize for discovering nothing? It means you're insane. Because it's not there, nothing. You can't discover it. You can't be it. They have their law of thermodynamics about matter and energy. No matter and energy can ever be destroyed. It can sort of spread out, entropy. But then, gee whiz, once it spreads out, maybe it comes together again. Who knows? Right? But they think it's nothing. and they're sure of it. Blind faith. That's all that is. It, although, actually, you're a yogi, so you should know. The third immaterial realm in the phenomenology of altered states through meditation from ancient time is called Akimjani Ayatana. It's called the realm of absolute, of nothing whatsoever, literally. I shouldn't use absolute. Of nothing whatsoever. Akimjani Ayatana. In a way, it's not nothing. It's called the medium or realm of, you know, realm of Ayatana means that in which something can spread. So it's the medium. You shouldn't say realm because that means a volume, a space. It's a medium of nothing whatsoever. And what that means is that you can have a meditative experience where you run into a kind of, you go into an oblivion that on the threshold of which you feel you have encountered the ultimate reality meditatively. If you're not forewarned, that anything you encounter is relative because you're encountering, you know, mind is a relational thing. So if you're not fully aware of what's called the royal reason of relativity and have it deeply embedded in your mind, in your realistic worldview, you might feel that you've run into the giant black stone, like in that perfect illustration of absolutism in Kubrick's movie. You know, you run into God, you know, which is a big black stone that's absolute, although I can relate to it by being absorbed in it. And they say someone who has had that visceral yogic experience is very hard to convince, you know, to be reasonable, to that they can evolve further, that there's meaning to the universe. It's a form of a charvaka or lokayata, a nihilist, that is more or less incurable. And then there's a form of Buddhist who thinks that's emptiness or something, and then they say that's one who's taken the medicine of emptiness, which is leads to relativity understanding, and made a poison out of it by becoming absolutely attached to it. So that one should be aware of that. Anyway, illusory relativity are open to hypotheses, explorable by experience, experiment, experience superior to inference, as you said, David, belief, mind as subtle energy more powerful than subtle matter, though requires highly advanced training to master coarse matter. So that's where the sort of siddhis come from, you know, the urdhis and siddhis and things that we would consider magical, you know, the abhijñas, the magical knowledges and magical powers, you know. They come from someone who has mastered, who can boil their subjectivity down to the super subtle cellular level, subcellular level, let's say. Wisdom, potential, unlimited, automatically empowers compassion and deathlessly transformative. And that's all based on the physical discovery. You know, therefore, highly credible is the reason for saying that. And this is one of my favorite things. Posthumously, people will celebrate me for this one. They never will while I'm alive, because they just won't argue. Karma. Karma simply means cause and effect. And by the way, where does it come from in terminology? Lisa, you like terminology. Where does karma come from?
Action.
Karma comes from the Vedic ritual, the word, and samskara also, if you know Sanskrit. A karma was a ritual act. Because when you made an offering to Mitra or Indra through the priest, or Soma or something through the priest, then that affected your fate. So that's because the ritual is what controlled reality. The gods were manipulated by the priests to exercise their power to control reality in your favor. Or if a ritual is done against you. And so karma were actions that were ritually volitional, affecting your evolutionary fate. So in Buddha's time, the word was taken out of there to indicate evolutionary causality. Killing someone was a powerful act that affected your evolutionary fate. You couldn't go to perform a ritual to expiate the killing or say it was an untouchable and I'm a warrior so I can kill whoever I like, or as long as it isn't a Brahmin or something. In other words, you got off the ethical barter system of the Vedic ritual thing and onto an abstract system of merit, demerit, ethical action, evolutionary, becoming evolutionary action. So and I put it this way from a modern point of view. There's a book called Mind and Cosmos by the NYU philosopher Thomas Nagel, recent book of his, very good philosopher, where he calls for, he says he's sure there could be, if they broke down this barrier about not allowing mind to exist in part of the causal processes of the universe, which they have because they fear that if they let it back in, the scientists, everybody will start praying to God and they'll all go to Arkansas and become creationists. And they think the only alternative to their radical, you know, materialistic reductionism is theism. And he says, no, there must be a way of letting mind come in a causal way, where mind is just a subtle energy involved with material energies. And you get more subtle in your analysis of biology by allowing the mind to affect it, you know, to bring minds in there, in other words, and not being materialistic reductionist only. You can do that, but then you can use analyses that involve allowing mind to be part of the process. So he calls for that. A scientific theory that describes the causal processes determining the variety, flourishing, and decay of life forms, and centrally includes the fact of the presence of mind in nature, and seeks to include empirically refinable hypothetical descriptions of mental, physical, causal processes. Because karmic description is, of course, also hypothetical. It's not all theories are relative, more or less valid within specific relative contexts. There's no absolute theory except that, that negation. Right? So Darwin's big discovery, right? Our genes were chimpanzee genes and this and that. Why they so freak out about him are primitive people in the Midwest, you know, and here and there, because they don't want to be related to black people. Males don't want to be related to have been females. They don't want to be related to monkeys or dogs or things that they eat. They don't want to have been something that they want to eat. You know, they also, the Judeo-Christian thing also, that the animal have no soul, so they're just there to be eaten. You know, also a ridiculous idea. So Darwin shocked them by saying we're all in a spectrum of connection to all animal life. And we've evolved from all those kind of species. But where Darwin falls short of Buddha 2,500 years earlier is Darwin says it's just that some genes doing this. There's no mind in it. The mind, the soul, you know, he threw out when his daughters died and he hated their God and the church and he said, forget it. There's no soul. It's just natural selection. There's no mental element. There's no individual. There was one guy was at Lamarck, maybe not Lamarck. There was some guy who had a kind of Mendel, somebody who thought maybe there was a soul running around in there, you know. Goethe also thought so. The vital principle, you know. They had a heretical bunch of ideas like that. But they didn't know quite how to handle it because they were still going on the old, more rigid idea of a soul. But the point is that the Indians had a soul, but which to them was a super subtle mental process, not a fixed thing, but an individual one. And unless you become enlightened, then in a way Buddha is beyond being individual. But he's any individual, something like that. One with all of them. So ahead of Darwin, in rejecting the creator and seeing the kinship of all animal species, and adding to that gods, demons, hell beings, hungry ghosts, and titans, some kind of Arnold sort of type of people. Discerned interconnectedness of all species of animals, including micro and macro forms of life, many other creatures, fully accepting of relativity without being nihilistic. Yeah, shunyata, back on the physics, is the discovery of relativity, of course. Absolute, complete relativity, not just partial relativity, where speed of light is absolute or something. That's a materialistic relativity and not a complete one. Person's relative mind, spirit, or soul are part of it. Mind is a strong causal factor in the creation of brain. Brain then becomes the instrument of mind. Ethics causes humanity. Generosity causes wealth, patience, beauty, compassion, bliss. If you're a beautiful person, you were patient in a previous life. If you're ugly, you were angry in a previous life. That, you know, that's on a broad level. And then they have very specific, one that I don't get at all. If your environment is always messy, your office, your room, your desk, whatever it is, you were a big gossip in previous life. Why is that? I don't know. I never found the reasoning behind that. But if you tend to be messy around you, you are a big gossip. You spoke frivolously and meaninglessly, a lot of meaningless things. I don't know why. Then they had a depth psychology, okay? Subconscious, found millennia. And this is all goes with actually yoga, too, not just Buddhism. Before Freud, Taoist, Christian mystics, Sufis. But some mystics in different religions were, of course, aware of that. id as repository of all evil drives eros and thanatos, lust and hate, sex and death. Sublimation processes well worked out. Contemplative technologies fully developed. Subconscious, however, not considered inevitably unconscious. Enlightened person specifically defined as one who has become fully conscious of subconscious, reshaping its drives and instincts, free from any involuntary control by them. And then these is with the yogas are the transformative technologies, ethical system based on realistic worldview, supporting naturalistic internalization. That is to say, you save life rather than take a life, because by saving a life, you identify with the being that you save. By taking a life, you're saying that being who had that body is not connected to me. So you're isolating, you're reinforcing your sense of separateness, your misknowledge about your separateness from the world, and therefore you're becoming more diminished as a being. You're not expanding to identify with reaching toward oneness of all life in your experimental or experiential, visceral experience. So therefore, you save lives because it not only does it help the person's life you save, of course, but because it expands your life. Their life becomes part of your life. You have a bigger life. If you take life, you diminish your life. Right? That's totally logical. Contemplative methodology is finely tuned. Blah, 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 blah. We have that. Distinctive specialty is the arts of identity formation, critical deconstruction, and creative reconstruction. That's your Ashtanga thing, right? You deconstruct by stretching, loosening the armoring of the person who grows up in militaristic culture in Texas, where they're beaten up in football. They do the yoga. They do yoga in your high school. It's football. And it's a yoga of insensitivity, violence, meanness, and victory by violence, right? Separate from the other team, creates a militant mindset and leads to good recruits for the military, right? It old days, killing some Indians, enslaving some blacks. Nowadays, where we have the Vietnamese, and I don't know who we finally have everybody now. Sort of. And then a lot of people trying to get out of it by yoga. So you break down that structuring, what Wilhelm Reich would call emotional armoring in the physical body, loosening up the grantas, right? And then you develop your inner energies and you become attuned to your inner strengths and powers. But then once you even do that, you then structure them to function in a good way. That's why you have to do this form. That's why Guruji gives you a whack when you don't say exactly that way and you put your hands out like this. That's why you have to do that. That's the restructuring, right? Something like that. And then, of course, but mentally, the Tantra, and this is where Tantra comes in, Tantra, those things like multi-armed deities, like over there, see Book of the Dead, those are the Heruka figures with wings and multiple arms, three faces, ferocious, etc. Then you have peaceful ones on the other side looking all kind of pleasant and erotic. And what those things are where you go in meditatively, into the model of your body that you have in your brain, right? Everybody has a model of their own body and their brain, right? Because we know that, like, you amputate an arm and then you still have your arm there for quite a while. Because the neural pattern is reproduced in the brain, and then the brain thinks it has the arm, whether the actual nerve is there, whether the thing has been cut off or not. Which means that we inhabit the body through a model, and that model structures the central nervous system to go out and have motor nerves and move the muscles this and that way. And actually, you're indirectly interfering with that and improving that model and improving the function through the asanas, through yoga. But the deeper one, the deepest one, is where you go right to the model itself, and you identify in the Hinduism with Shiva, or with Uma, Parvati, or the Shakti, and you go in there and then you create a model of a body that looks very, or Bhairava, they have multiple arm things too, the Shaivite and Shakta Tantrikas. And you actually feel you have a body like that, to create a model in the nervous system. And that affects your inner sensitivity, your inner openness to the central channel, and all this kind of thing. And it's just so incredibly sophisticated. It's psychoneurology, really. And that's what those things are about. They're not about there's some guy out there that you're calling, come flap, flap with your wings and be fierce and do something. It isn't like that. You know, there are entities like this that are around, who are so-called protectors and positive and negatives, and there's demons too. But that's not what those are. These are archetypes that you consciously inhabit by using emptiness to make yourself more resilient and flexible about your self-model, and then build a better, not to have no model, mm-hmm. but to build a, to be able to build, be an artist of building a better model of your body and mind.
Is the Sanskrit word samskara good for this idea of restructuring?
Yeah, samskara is a mental function or a structural function. Yes, sort of like that. Samskara is a derivative of karma word, same word. And samskara would be a ritual arrangement in the old Vedic thing, you know, a particular rigid pattern of acts, you know. But samskara becomes an internal emotional pattern of acts, yes. And samskara, you could use samskara for that. Samskara also just means samskrita. Means, you know, creation, a making of something, creation. Sam means altogether, and krita means made. So samskrita. Samskrit means, therefore, artificially made language. Mm-hmm. It's therefore an ideal scientific language. Samskrita is what it is.
I think of it as I think of it as regrooving, like, you know.
Yeah, something, yeah, yeah, sure. Reprogramming. It's software. It's psycho-neuro computer science. It's so cool. India is. It's India. It's not just Buddhist, you know, or Hindus or something. Or this, that. It's India. And why were they cool? It isn't that they're so great either. They were richer. They were California in ancient time. It was India. It was topless society. It's climate, you know. The ladies were like, behave, you know, got the guys to behave themselves slowly and gradually. And that's why the Brahmins were upset a little bit, you know. So when the Muslims came and wrecked all the Buddhist universities, then the Brahmins said, oh, great, we've got it under control again. We'll have our caste and we'll put those ladies back in the sack. Oh, the Muslims agree with us that those ladies should go back in the sack. Oh. Meanwhile, the ladies are the Shaktis, you know. And they... That vision about, you know, enlightenment is getting rid of this self-centeredness and a noble becomes more selfless. I'm not just getting brownie points, although I don't mind that. But the female form is more advanced in that direction than the male form. You know, people always get mad at Buddha. Feminists do. Because when his foster mother and ex-wife came and said they wanted to be monks... You know, they wanted to join the community, you know, and live. It isn't really monk, wasn't the word. Bhikshu and bhikshuni. And bhikshu means a mendicant, someone who gets a free lunch from society. You know, that's basically all. They're not like isolated. They weren't necessarily, you know, hermits. They were, in fact, he made the monasteries in the suburbs where they had to go every day to get food, and they couldn't get 3 days' food. Unless it was a special rains retreat or a special retreat for some reason at some stage in the development, they could only get today's food, so they would have to go back. And then they would offer a little discourse to the layperson who gave them the food, although they didn't want them to say thank you. The lay people didn't want them to say thank you. They just wanted the merit of giving them food. So when those ladies came and said, we want to join this, we're tired of the palace, we don't want to do this, and we don't want to do householding anymore, we want to leave the household, and he said, no, I don't think we can deal with women. And then two times he said no. And each time then his cousin, Ananda, who was interceding for them, kept saying, come on, what does this mean? Women can't attain enlightenment. He said, no, they can attain them more easily. It's just that we can't house them, we can't take care of them. He said, the society won't tolerate them dropping out like that. He said, it'll shorten the length of the mendicant community. And absolutely happened, actually. Why? Because the women in those societies were slaves. They did, and they still are in the villages. They bear the children, unpaid labor. They plant the things. They pick the weeds. They do the cooking. They do everything. Those guys sit there smoking their hookah. Ram, ram, you know. Like, come on. So they, you know, and they marry off the daughters to some wealthy guy around the corner, some funky old wealthy guy. Forget about romance. So they were happy to get out of there. There's some early bhikshuni mendicant, female mendicant. Then Buddha said, okay, fine, you know, when they insisted, And then he made rules to make it a little tougher for them so they wouldn't come. And then there was a stampede to get out of their household slavery, of course, as he predicted. And then the Brahmins got a little more uptight about it. You know, the authorities, you know. So many women. And there's some early mendicant poems saying, "Oh, I just finished my lunch. All I have is the one bowl. Someone gave me this nice rice. And I just wipe it clean and put it in my little shoulder sack here. Now I'm meditating under a tree, thinking about selflessness, or thinking about the five aggregates, or thinking about the measurable love, joy, compassion, equanimity. Oh, Buddha, thank you, Buddha. If this isn't nirvana, it's close enough. You saved me from three crooked things. My rice-smashing pestle that I used to have to make the rice with. My bent-over old mother-in-law. And my hunchback husband." "I don't care if I get nirvana or not. I'm happy." Now, that's all. Yeah, this I didn't explain. This is medicine, but this is Menla. That's the Buddha when he decided to teach medicine. And he was in the outskirts of Vaishali, a great city in nowadays Bihar, but at that time one of the great cities on one of the rivers there, and trading city. And he created this vision, that's a mandala, and invited, you see Ganeshas up there, Brahma, all those, Dhananjaya, the Ayurvedic like deities types are there. And then down here on the lower right are the rishis, you know, the funky guys with the long hair and the unshaven, whatever, you know, the sadhu rishis. And then there are some bodhisattvas, celestial bodhisattvas. You know, there are monks up on that side, and then there are some celestial bodhisattvas over here. So those are called the four audiences. And then there's a medicine city. I guess it's the city of Vaishali outside around that. And then all the herbs and trees and medicines and minerals and animal parts and whatever are used in medicine, because everything becomes medicine. You know, in the vision of the true healer, you know exactly, even arsenic is medicine in the tiny in the tiniest amount, you know, like equivalent of homeopathic amount. But there's also allopathic medicine, and there's arura trees, the arubarukuru, the various kinds of arura in that. That's the eastern direction in this case. The southern direction, where there's a sun, it's where the hot medicines grow, the peppers and the cayennes and things that build up, eliminate the kapha, you know, the phlegmatic element in the body. And up there are moon-blessed herbs that cool you down, sandalwood and such things, and cool down the feverish type of things. And then there are mineral waters over there, and that's the medicine Buddha vision. And so our dream here at Menla is to have this be this place, where people step on it and then suddenly they see everything as healing instead of fearing it as a danger. But we hadn't figured out how to banish the ticks yet. So we're a little short. We haven't quite reached there yet.
Is that the central stupa there?
What?
Is that the medicine Buddha in the center?
That's medicine Buddha, yeah, the blue one. He turned into that deep blue because that deep blue is the color of ultimate reality, perfection, wisdom, which is the transmutation of the energy of anger or hatred, which doesn't like any imperfection, you know, which analyzes, which dissects things to find their reality. And what it discovers is that ultimate reality is perfect, actually, nirvana, satchitananda, this type of thing. But relative reality isn't. So there's no relative reality that's perfect. Even such a mandala is still a relative reality, but it's an extraordinary one that gives you a boost toward discovering nirvana and satchitananda and so on. Well, this is another sutra. I don't know if I want to go into that today. I don't think so. Because it is six, that's what we have to stop. So I'm not going to go into that today. Okay? Lisa Ananda, you must have one more question before we go.
I feel like I need to digest it all and try to make it into one question. It's just
one great big goopy ball.
One great big question. I think what I'm trying to do is. I think the reason I keep asking questions is because I think I'm trying to relate it to what I understand from yoga knowledge.
From yoga?
From yoga knowledge. From
yoga knowledge, right, sure.
And,
this is another kind of more added things to yoga knowledge, sure.
Yeah. So,
good.
So one of my questions has to do with Okay. So one of my questions has to do with, I'm trying to get there. Firstly, it seems like the Buddha has given like a path with technologies of how to live life and transcend the suffering. Yeah.
Eventually, and to evolve into being a better being.
Yes. Now, is that necessarily theistic?
Is that necessarily what?
Necessarily theistic?
No, it's neither. Well, if you think of theistic, one does in the West think of theistic as a belief in a monotheistic creator. And it is not that.
Okay.
So therefore, many people have thought in history that Buddhism was atheistic.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm just saying it's neither theistic. It's neither theistic in a monotheistic sense, nor is it atheistic.
Okay,
however, it doesn't deny, it's not material, it does not deny the existence of beings higher than human beings. Definitely not. Angels, gods, demons, they are there as far as Buddhists are concerned. Certainly.